This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies. Next week, Jon Stewart ends his 16-year run as host of The Daily Show on Comedy Central. A lot of Daily Show viewers share the sentiment expressed by President Obama when he made his seventh and final appearance on the show last week.
You know,
you're on your way out.
I can't believe that you're leaving before me. In fact, I'm issuing a new executive order that Jon Stewart cannot leave the show. It's being challenged in the courts.
Yes.
Stewart took over The Daily Show anchor desk in 1999. His quick wit and biting satire took the once obscure fake news show and made it an influential voice in American humor and politics. The program won Peabody Awards in 2000 and 2004 for its election coverage and has won numerous Emmys. Stewart shortened his name from Jon Stewart Leibowitz because he said it sounded too Hollywood. Stewart started doing stand-up in the mid-'80s, got a show on MTV and an HBO special, and had parts in several movies before taking over The Daily Show. In 2014, he directed his first film, Rosewater. I spoke to Stewart in 2004 when he and The Daily Show published a book called America, A Citizen's Guide to Democracy in Action.
Do you have as much fun doing that show as it looks like you're having?
No.
No.
Let me explain something. Our entire day is focused on taking the unfun we have, making it, and turning it into fun when it gets on the air. Because we function actually very similarly probably to a news show in that we have sort of an editorial meeting in the morning. It's a really structured day. We actually do have a very good time doing it, but it's sort of relentless, and it's a lot of the structure of our day is a lot more rigid, I think, than people would imagine.
You start by reading the New York Times, The Economist, everything, watching a million news clips?
No, we get most of our news from the tickers on the top of cabs. So it starts from that. Our day usually starts with sports scores.
Building it from the ground up, right.
Exactly. We normally, you know, the papers are not, it's not like we come in at 8:30 and start reading the paper and go, ooh, this story's interesting. I mean, we're working, the beautiful thing about faking a news show is the topicality is delayed. And the truth is, it helps us more to have saturation of a news story because then everybody's very familiar with the parameters of it. So we generally are working a day or two ahead.
How much of it do you write? How much of it do your writers come up with?
I write the entire program. What I like to do is come in, write the entire program, and treat my staff to hot stone massages.
That's boy.
It's just how I like to work. Yeah. I'll come in around 7, have half a grapefruit, do some jazzercise, and then just get to writing.
God, you are as decent a man as we thought.
Oh, it's absolutely unbelievable. We have an unbelievable staff of writers, Ben Carlin, the executive producer, DJ Javerbaum, who's the head writer, and then all the writers, the correspondents. For me, I can literally show up at 5 pretty drunk, and as long as the show is spelled out phonetically on the prompter, you know, I'll do okay. Just have to face the right direction. Well, I sort of function as, in some respects, in the same way you would imagine the anchor functions as a managing editor type.
There was recently the Columbia Journalism Review, one of the most respected journalism publications in the country, had a website in which they asked their readers to poll those who were doing the best at covering the presidential campaign. You came in 4th, well above people in the New York Times and other better-known publications.
Yes. Now, that is either a terrible statement about the state of news in our country or the state of comedy on our program. I'm not sure which. Probably both.
All right. Well, I want to play a clip that might give us a little insight into why someone might mistake you for a journalist. And this is you interviewing former Republican Congressman Henry Bonilla. And I believe this was during the time of Democratic National Convention. And he was a part of the Republicans' rapid response team. So let's listen to Jon Stewart interviewing former Republican Congressman Henry Bonilla.
But so I turn on the TV and they say, he's the first most liberal senator, John Kerry. John Edwards is the 4th most liberal senator.
Right.
So the only thing, because I watch that at home and I'm stupid. How do they figure that?
We have votes in bills that we sponsor and they
I'm
track.
I'm not retarded. I mean, how do they compile?
They list them. You take a list.
But who's they?
These groups that I told you about.
But which one is the one that said they're the first and the 4th?
Well, you take the trial lawyers or the people that follow the union votes and the people who follow the small business votes or the corporate votes, and right. They all go, you're either with us 100% of the time or 0% of the time, and they kind of average them all together.
Who?
These groups do.
But which one, how do you, when you say first most liberal and fourth most liberal, what is the group and how is it, because I'm not...
No, I hope I'm explaining it clearly.
I don't think
okay.
so. I don't, it's coming, it's starting
we'll
to come.
Try again. We'll try again.
That's very funny stuff, but this was a real interrogation. I mean, you were doing what journalists do there.
No, I think I actually was doing what journalists don't do. I think that's why I voted high. Isn't that the issue? The journalists don't do that. That basically, when you're, and I'm not talking about print, but isn't the issue that on television, those sorts of operatives for both political parties go on the air and say, John Kerry is the first most liberal, or the new jobs created are $9,000 less. And nobody ever says, I'm sorry, I don't mean to stop you, but what? What was that? Where do you come up with these numbers?
Right. But, I mean, do you feel yourself getting pulled into doing a job that journalists ought to be doing? I mean...
No. I don't, because I feel myself being pulled into areas that strike me as of interest to me. And that strikes me as an area of interest that so many of these, you know, these political parties, it's very interesting, but they've... You know, they are basically dedicated to figuring out how to game the system. And they have found, I think, the real vulnerability in our media. And they are exploiting that loophole. And the vulnerability is twofold. One is the pace at which the 24-hour networks have. So it's sort of their deadline pressure. And the other is that the anchors are not versed in an expertise of news. They are TV people. And so those two together form sort of a conspiracy of a non-aggression pact, if you will. And it allows these talking point robots, operatives from different political parties, to go on these shows and basically lay it out there without question. And it's done to influence people through repetition.
So deceptive content never gets challenged. Nobody ever gets to the bottom of it.
I wouldn't say never, but the prevailing sense is that if it is challenged, it's in print and a week later when the information is available. And if I know it, it's clearly available because I'm not exactly, you know, I'm not like one of the old guys with a metal detector on the beach searching for, like, it's there on my computer right. Pretty much when I boot it up.
But I guess what a producer of a talk show or Crossfire might say is, but you know, in the great marketplace of ideas, we our solution is to provide competition. The other side is always there, and if one side has phony talking points, the other side's right there. Doesn't that work?
Doesn't seem to be. I mean that's not in the marketplace of ideas. From what I understand, there aren't only two products available. Mm-hmm. That's like saying, you know, fair competition is soda machines with only Coke and Pepsi in them. And the other side of it is, what is the expertise of the anchor? What is your role then? That's like saying the referee for a football game is just there to make sure no one dies. You know, there are, should be, truths, actual truths, and someone should be there to help arbitrate that. And it seems to be that media should be the forum for that. For instance, on Crossfire, I'm not sure what those guys are doing there other than egging their own side on. Mm-hmm. And if anything, I think that puts out misinformation or disinformation because it vouches for deception. By allowing it on television, you are vouching for it. You're saying, these people, we've done a background check. They're okay. It's like the Swift Boat veteran guys. They go right on TV.
Right, they're granted the credibility of wide access, right?
Absolutely. They're granted the credibility of, and it's not enough to bring someone on from the Democratic side and say, well, actually, this isn't true. Someone has to earn some credibility here, don't they? Isn't that the role of the anchor, or is the anchor just a tool?
Well, you know, somebody I know, after seeing you eviscerate the Swift Boat veterans in one of the pieces that you did on The Daily Show, yelled at the television, the Kerry campaign ought to buy this stuff. They ought to put on, that's what they ought to be using. Are you selling?
Sorry?
Okay, I said, are you selling? I mean, would you give it? I mean, how would you feel about your material being used for a partisan purpose? I mean, if
hey,
you,
good
if,
luck to you. If you feel like comedy program bits are your best effort as far as selling your candidate, good luck to you. You know, I think that the difficulty here is they're doing the same thing. Our role is to make it as funny and smart as we can possibly make it, but base it upon something that is frustrating for us to watch. And it's frustrating for me. You know, I watch these 24-hour news networks all day long. You know, it's because I night manage a Bennigan's, and I just happen to have it on.
But what a life.
It's really quite incredible. But in general, you know, I think it's they have abdicated their role. You know, politicians are doing, of course they're doing what they do. They're trying to get away with as much as they can get away. But what I'm saying is political parties are working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day to find the loopholes and vulnerabilities in the media system. And the media has to be better. The problem is the media isn't monolithic. We sort of keep talking about the media. And unfortunately, it's a series of these fiefdoms. And they have figured out how to play these fiefdoms off against each other. It's that competition. If you question us on our talking points. Here's an example. I was watching during the Republican convention, Dick Cheney's daughter, and not the one that they hide, the other one, was on, I think it was Anderson Cooper's show. And she was doing the Republican talking points about John Kerry and the thing. And Anderson Cooper, to his credit, stopped her and said, well, you know, to be fair, you're sort of taking that out of context. And literally he interrupted twice and she said very angrily, what are you, a surrogate? And I thought, wow, is that where we've gotten? We've gotten to the point where if an anchor interrupts a talking point, you accuse them of being an operative, which, by the way, is also a strategy to discredit the person that disagrees with you. The other example was Zell Miller went on a Hardball after his relatively insane rant that if you listen to without the picture reminded you very much of Strom Thurmond's famous 1948 speech, but not in content so much as delivery. Uh-huh. But so Chris Matthews questioned him on, you really think John Kerry would defend this country with spitballs? And Zell Miller was so upset at being questioned, he challenged Chris Matthews to a duel, mm-hmm. which is basically, you know, the idea is if the news media questions my talking points.
You grew up in I guess, Lawrenceville, New Jersey.
That is correct.
Were you a class clown? Did you have the sort of persona that made fun of everybody in a kind of playful and endearing way?
Yes, I was very playful and endearing.
That was you.
Yeah, people always say, you know, when did you realize you were funny? And I think it's not that you realize you were funny. It's that your brain works in a certain way. And I don't think that that's – I think in some respects it's uncontrollable. And you can either accept it and deal with it and hone it, or you can try and fight it. And I was too weak to fight it. And so I just sort of went with it. And the big thing to learn was how to turn obnoxiousness into wit. And that was the hardest, probably, lesson. Obnoxiousness is what gets your butt kicked. And wit is what makes people go, oh, that's endearing. And it's trying not to get your butt kicked while still having your brain work in the way that you're comfortable with.
What do you mean by your brain works in a different way?
It, for some reason, defaults to a joke. I don't know why it does that. It certainly isn't helpful. It didn't help me keep any other job other than this one. But for some reason, it always looks to mischief. Mm-hmm. For instance, I didn't do any theater or anything like that when I was younger, but we did do one senior year in high school. We were in a play called The Pajama Game. And our first night performing it at the high school in front of a full crowd, and everybody took it very seriously and rightfully so. My friends and I were in the chorus. We did Steam Heat, you know, very powerful version, I might add. But there's one scene at a picnic where the two lovers finally come together at the front of the stage, and they're alone on stage, and it's in front of a backdrop of trees. And as they were out there just about to begin this beautiful duet, I wandered out and put my back to the audience and pretended I was relieving myself on one of the trees. Now, as you can imagine, the crowd found this somewhat amusing. The two actors on stage, not so much. The director of the play, again, sided with the actors, not so much. Me, I thought, oh, my God, I'm killing. This is awesome. This play is going great. And this is what I'm suggesting to you, is that it's learning when to use it, how to use it. But by God, there's nothing else you can do. It's just some reason in any situation it occurs to you that wouldn't it be funny if. And that's that.
Right. You went to college, William & Mary, and right. I read that you were 23 when you had a job with the state of New Jersey and, you know, looking forward to a reasonably happy life with a car and, you know, making your way through the world. And you decided to go to New York and do stand-up. And at first just got brutalized, as people do. And I'm wondering, you know, there are lots of people who are funny that make their friends laugh, make their family laugh. And then when they get on stage and try and make an audience laugh, it just doesn't work.
Yeah, that was me.
What is it? I mean, you were so funny. You had that brain working that way. What was it you didn't know?
What was it I didn't know about which?
About why didn't it work? Why is being funny with your friends not the same thing as...
Well, because it's a craft. You know, it isn't... There's a big difference between having an analytical mind and being a good scientist. There is a craft to learn. And that was the biggest lesson, is that it takes, again, it's that idea of turning obnoxiousness into wit or comedy. You know, creating something from nothing is different from just being reactive at a bar. And you have to create the atmospheric conditions for comedy. Comedy is oddly enough, very fragile and can be thrown off by, you know, a glass breaking or somebody talking or, you know, there's a lot of different elements to it that... And construction of a joke, you know, you have to create. One of the things about being funny in life is the premise is already there.
Right.
Typically, when you're with your friends, premises are coming up left and right. But when you're on stage, you must create the premise. So you have to create the premise, paint the picture, and then deliver the punchline. You have to take them from their, you know, sitting, you know, their lack of movement. You take them from zero to laughter. Whereas in life, all that inertia is already presented, and you're just deflecting it. Being funny in life is a lot more like, you know, judo. It's using the energy that's coming at you to your advantage.
Right.
Doing stand-up comedy is in the middle of a traffic jam, getting everybody moving again. You know, it's a totally different skill and environment, and one that is learned.
Right. Well, John Stewart, thanks so much for spending some time with us.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
John Stewart recorded in 2004. His last show will be next Thursday, August 6th. To commemorate the end of his 16-year run, we'll listen back to Stewart's many appearances on Fresh Air, including his 2010 interview with Terry on stage at the 92nd Street Y in New York. By the way, Stewart has confirmed the last three guests for his final week: Amy Schumer, Dennis Leary, and Louis C.K. On Monday, writer Buzz Bissinger joins us. His best-selling book, Friday Night Lights, about a Texas town's obsession with high school football, became a movie and a TV series. For a new 25th anniversary edition, he checks in on the players he wrote about, now middle-aged men. And he'll tell us about his obsession with leather, his shopping addiction to tight-fitting designer clothes, and going into rehab for treatment. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.